From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is a special report on hearings by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation about incinerating wastes from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Good morning, I'm Steve Heimel. The hearings began last night in Anchorage, and it quickly became clear that there's substantial public opposition to burning the oily waste in Alaska. Exxon projects its total waste stream from the spill at as much as 50,000 tons. The two incinerator companies now under contract for burning it could deal with as much as 250 tons of that a day, about the same as the amount now being sent to the lower 48. Already, Exxon is using small unregulated incinerators in Valdez to burn 4 to 8 tons a day and is shipping another 10 to 20 tons a day to Prudhoe Bay to be burned at an incinerator up there. People testifying in Anchorage said they weren't sure the current burning was safe, and most don't want any more. They probably won't get any more, at least this year. Exxon engineer Rob Dragnet says time is growing short and permits for the floating incinerators could still be more than a month away.
At this point, we are not optimistic that we will be allowed to use either of the offshore incinerators this year. If the permitting logjam cannot be resolved quickly, we will have no choice but to demobilize these units and continue disposing of the bulk of the waste in out-of-state landfills.
Dragnet accuses the Department of Environmental Conservation of changing the ground rules at the last minute. He says originally there was not going to be any state regulation on emissions of dioxins and furans. These are highly toxic materials formed by the burning process. They're called unregulated emissions in the incinerator business because the Environmental Protection Agency has not yet set standards for them. But under pressure from environmentalists, the state changed its mind and decided it would regulate dioxins after all. DEC's John Sandstead says federal technical help made the difference.
Well, initially we did propose to go with the combustion-related criteria. At that point we did ask for assistance from the EPA technical experts to kind of validate our approach because the waste stream is so unlike anything that there's any sufficient amount of data generated for. We definitely do feel that the combustion-related approach or an approach requiring good combustion practices and good flue gas cleaning will minimize dioxin formation, but without actual testing for dioxins, that's a very difficult thing to provide any absolute assurances. And that is why we had to rethink our initial strategy of only going with the combustion-related criteria and decided to add the testing requirements. And now that added a little bit to the process because there are currently no federal test methods for dioxins, and that's where we needed some EPA assistance as well to recommend some test protocol for doing the actual dioxin test.
Most of those giving testimony said the more regulation and monitoring, the better. For Deborah Williams of the Alaska Lung Association, that means monitoring the air in communities near the burning.
These are extraordinary circumstances. I believe Alaskans will demand, and Alaskans certainly deserve, ambient monitoring under these circumstances. Exxon should pay for this ambient monitoring. It should be ambient monitoring at all affected population sites.
Williams added the incinerators now operating ought to be shut down.
Immediately, absolutely tomorrow, if possible, either this should be discontinued or ambient monitors should be put in place to find out what the effect of this incineration is having on the health of Alaskans in that area.
Cleanup worker Jed Whitaker said the oil is making workers sick. David McCargo of the Alaska Wildlife Federation said we're being used as a test area. But David Robbins of the Alaska Center for the Environment said nobody seems to be learning much.
I mean, I heard a lot about learning from the oil spill way back in the days of March when I was back in Boston, that everyone would learn from this. It doesn't seem like anyone wants to learn about waste disposal.
DEC is looking at four permit applications for incinerators. Two of them are from companies that don't have contracts with Exxon but claim they have better equipment. Perry Lopez of Shellstead Limited says their combination of equipment could take most of the spill contaminated material and recycle it.
The reduction could be as much as 85 to 90%.
DEC says it could award permits to any or none of the incineration applicants. It's closing the comment period at the end of the month. But with Exxon looking at a mid-September shutdown date, it's hard to see how much incinerating the big offshore rigs will get to do this year. I'm Steve Heimel. This has been a special report from the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is a special report on hearings by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation about incinerating wastes from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Good morning. I'm Sue Rapley. The incinerator issue is a very emotional one in Valdez because three Exxon incinerators have been in use here for quite some time. They're small enough that Exxon didn't need DEC permits, but they're large enough to be burning 8 to 10 tons of oily debris every day. Although last night's public hearing was supposed to be focused on the possibility of new barge-loaded incinerators that would be anchored away from town, the majority of questions asked by the people of Valdez were about the operation already in progress. And when it came time to testify, the majority of residents spoke against accepting additional risks.
Personally, I'm against the incineration of hazardous waste here in Valdez. It seems to me that the government has approved the burial of nuclear waste in New Mexico, and they've determined that that's environmentally safe. Much of this waste apparently is being planned to be buried in the lower 48. Therefore, I assume there must be safe ways of burying this stuff elsewhere. And as a resident of Valdez, I don't know why, having had everything we've had, we should be required to take the risk of breathing something bad when there is safe disposal. I can only assume the reason that they want to dispose of it with incinerators is because that might be less expensive than transporting it elsewhere. Since I live here and would rather not breathe it and face the risk that some contaminant wasn't noticed during the 90-day period we're burning it, I would be very happy if all the stuff were buried rather than burned.
The minimum standards established in applicable laws and regulations don't approach the pre-spill air quality and in the quality of the environment that we had here in Prince William Sound. The quality of our environment has already been severely damaged as a result of this spill. Further pollution at any level of our air, water, and natural food supply, the quality of the ecosystem that supports us, or a reduction in the quality of the ecosystem that supports us, as it has in the past, is not acceptable. Packaging and transportation and storage of this waste is already something that is in the mill. There is monitoring of these dump sites. There are approved dump sites in the lower 48 that are safe. This seems to me the only means by which we can guarantee no further damage to our environment as a result of this spill.
I would like to urge ADEC to consider in your permitting process a system that will provide continuous real-time monitoring rather than delayed monitoring or tests of conditions that existed hours before or days before. And if I'm not mistaken, I heard someone say up here today that if the emission standards were exceeded, that the on-site monitors would have the authority to slow or discontinue the feeding of the incinerators. I find that totally unacceptable. It reminds me of a speeding motorist who discontinues the fuel to their engine when they see the patrol car on the side of the road and then steps on the gas pedal again after they're passed. I don't see how that is really going to protect any of us who live here if you only suspend feeding the incinerators until the emission standards have dropped and then can start feeding them again.
I'm also very concerned about air quality, and I think incineration is far too complicated and controversial an issue to jump into quickly. And I hold very little sympathy for the accusations I've heard that the Department of Environmental Conservation is dragging their heels, acting too slowly, delaying the permitting process. I would personally like to encourage you to dig in your heels and make sure, take your time, please. Thank you.
DEC air quality hearings concerning the Exxon incinerators continue tonight in Seward. I'm Sue Rapley. This has been a special report from the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN.
Exxon would like to have two floating incinerators at work as soon as possible. The machines are both in Valdez right now, waiting for word from the state on whether or not they can be used. Exxon official Rob Dragnich says the company wants one of the incinerators to work in Herring Bay in Prince William Sound. That machine would burn primarily sorbent boom and pads used in the cleanup effort. The other machine is earmarked for Kukak Bay, across Shelikoff Strait from a fog neck island. That incinerator would burn rock, sand, and gravel that have been soaked with oil. Thursday night's meeting in Homer produced little public testimony, but hours of questions were asked during an informal workshop held before the actual hearing. The major concern was what kind of toxic material was going to be produced by the incinerators and what level of emission the state was going to allow. DEC spokesman John Sandstead said any permit issued will have emission standards for a number of different substances.
They'll be testing for hydrogen chloride, sulfur dioxide as well, and we're proposing that they test for dioxins and furans. The exact health effects are difficult to predict. It's been documented in laboratory studies with animals and other types of laboratory studies that dioxins and furans are a very potent carcinogen.
Sandstead told the Homer audience that there are no emission standards for dioxins, but the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is expected to come out with some regulations in a few months. He said the state will include dioxin standards in any permitted issues to Exxon for use of incinerators. Exxon engineer Rob Dragnich said he was aware that harmful substances such as dioxins would be produced in the incineration process, but he claimed they wouldn't be a threat to air quality.
The units that we have selected will be burning at 1,700 to 1,800 degrees or higher, which is above that threshold level that is generally considered adequate. The second part of that is to have sufficient emission control equipment to collect the particulates, ensure that there are not a lot of particulates being discharged. If any dioxins and furans are produced, and there will be minor trace amounts, certainly, those tend to stay with the particulates. By removing the particulates, we then remove the majority of the dioxins and furans and that sort of toxic from the air.
Keeping the majority of the harmful substances out of the air wasn't good enough for many of the people in the audience. A state law, which reads that any emission which is injurious to human health is not permittable, was highlighted by Annie McKenzie. The Seldovia resident said the number one concern of the DEC should be the protection of air quality, and no compromises should be made.
The information that I have, which is from Greenpeace, says that you cannot burn this material without forming dioxins, that dioxins, even in 50 parts per quadrillion, have caused cancer, birth defects, and damages to the reproductive systems of living things. Also, that dioxins are soluble in fat, but not in water, so they're not going to wash out of the body of animals. They're going to go up the food chain, which makes us intensely at risk. I simply want to state that I see it's DEC's responsibility to protect us in this area. It's a very complicated issue, and we in the public cannot address all of the questions and answer them. We want DEC to make the tough decisions that are necessary now. We will back them 100%. I think the state of Alaska, the people of Alaska, want those tough decisions made, and we'll back those decisions.
McKenzie's statement was typical of comments heard throughout the evening. No one supported the incineration of oil waste, and if it's going to be done, people demanded that DEC enforce strict standards. Sandstead said he understands what people are saying, and if there is a permit issued, it will contain tough emission standards. The public comment period on the incineration permits ends July 31st, and a decision is expected shortly after that. But even if Exxon is issued a permit, company officials say it may be too late in the year to use the incinerators, and the waste will continue to be shipped down to landfills in the lower 48. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
At Friday night's hearing, the panel included representatives from the Department of Environmental Conservation, Exxon, and two incinerator companies. They faced a deeply distrustful audience. For many Kodiak residents, like George Griffin, The plan to set an incinerator barge in the Shelikof Strait is like rubbing salt in a wound.
In light of the damage that's already been done here in Kodiak, the fact that our whole lifestyle has been threatened and people are going broke and our whole economy is on the edge now, isn't it a little insensitive for Exxon even to propose something like this when, in fact, we have enough to worry about already without you bringing in another problem? My suggestion, the most efficient way for you to get that oil out of here would be to take it out the same way it came in, and that's to float it out on a barge and take it with you wherever you want, and it be your problem instead of making it ours. We've had enough.
Exxon representative Rob Dragnich responded by saying there's a big potential for accidents during transportation, so it's safer to dispose of the waste as close to the area it's generated as possible. The potential for accidents is precisely the reason one audience member was concerned about installing a barge in the strait. John Hopkins said it was foolish to put the incinerator in one of the most dangerous stretches of water in the world. Exxon's Rob Dragnich, followed by John Hopkins.
We're not going to kill people in the operation if we can help it. We're not going to push the limits of the equipment and the technology. That's why we're making the point that we want to locate the barge where it is in protected waters. It's not going to attempt to be operating in open waters. The transportation will be basically the same system of transportation that we have in place today.
We had the same type of assurances, though, when the Valdez oil terminal was built, and we have an oil spill that wasn't supposed to happen. And it surprised everybody, really, because technologically people just didn't guess all the right guesses. And I'm a little worried about the same thing happening a second time.
As in the other hearings around the state, people had a lot of concerns about how stringent DEC's monitoring would be for the incinerators. The audience pressed DEC to expand its testing to include dioxins and furans and asked a DEC observer be on board the barges at all times. DEC Representative John Samstead said the agency was considering adding those requirements to the permit. But no matter what the permit requirements are, all those testifying at the hearing opposed the plan to put the barge at Kukak Bay. Kukak is surrounded by land belonging to Katmai National Park, and park officials worry toxic substances released into the air could harm the surrounding lands and water. Park Representative Will Troyer said an abundant number of brown bear feed in the area, and 9 active eagle nests are located on the shoreline. In addition, a large number of seabirds and sea mammals feed around Kukak. The bay is also used by commercial fishermen.
Sometimes 70 to 80 purse seiners are operating in the bay at a given time. And as one person remarked tonight, there may be more than that if it's the only area that gets open to fishing. Fishing for Dungeness crab and trawling for shrimp are of significant importance. The old village of Kukak is an important archaeological site, and the small beach near there has an abundance of razor clams, which are utilized by the fishermen for personal use. In short, the bay is extremely rich in fish, wildlife, and other resources. And, in fact, this bay on the Katmai coast is probably the most important and the richest in natural resources of the entire Katmai coast.
The Park Service feels other areas in the park would be more suitable for an incinerator barge. It's asking that Kodiak's Interagency Shoreline Committee be consulted to choose an alternative. Exxon's Rob Dragnich said they're open to suggestions for another site. DEC will continue to accept written comments until July 31st. Then decisions on the permits will be rendered within 30 days. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The barge is in Louisiana. The equipment is to be assembled and set up on the barge within 45 days. We could complete it within that time period.
The Alyeska is just a joke. It's a veil that the 7 owner companies, the Prudhoe producers, which includes all the big ones, have created basically to try to protect themselves from what they've in the past considered are irritating and irrelevant state regulatory procedures.
Both Exxon and Alyeska submitted what's called proposed findings and conclusions of fact their version of what the NTSB hearings uncovered regarding the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. The bottom line is, both companies say they bear no fault in the accident, which dumped more than 10 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound in just 5 hours. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, the consortium which was supposed to marshal an early response to the spill, says testimony at the NTSB hearing shows it had done what it was supposed to do. That is, it had met conditions of a government-approved contingency plan. Alyeska says nothing it did or didn't do that night would have made much difference in the damage the spill eventually caused. Alyeska repeated its complaint that it had been prevented unreasonably from getting rid of oil by burning it or applying quantities of chemical dispersant. The company also says it should be credited for keeping on hand more boom than the contingency plan required and for ordering more equipment and supplies from around the world to fight the spill. For its part, Exxon Shipping told the NTSB that based on all that panel members had heard during the Anchorage hearings, investigators should now conclude that the company had reacted quickly and appropriately to the spill. At the hearings, much time was spent on how well Exxon was monitoring the recovery of Captain Joseph Hazelwood, the skipper of the Exxon Valdez, who had undergone alcohol treatment at the company's expense. Exxon says the NTSB should conclude that the role of alcohol in the grounding of the ship must remain a mystery, since the company says no NTSB witness testified that Hazelwood was impaired by alcohol, and since Hazelwood himself never testified before the panel. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
At this point, we are not optimistic that we will be allowed to use either of the offshore incinerators this year. If the permitting logjam cannot be resolved quickly, we will have no choice but to demobilize these units and continue disposing of the bulk of the waste in out-of-state landfills.
According to officials at the Exxon Operations Briefing Center, cleanup teams bring in 3,000 to 4,000 bags of debris each day, amounting to over 8,500 tons. The debris is disposed of through incinerators and approved landfills down in Oregon. Exxon says most of it is being sent to the landfills, but about 9 to 10 tons a day are burned in the three incinerators on Dayville Road here in Valdez. 2 weeks ago, the City Council agenda included consideration of an air quality ordinance that had been tabled until the 1st July meeting. However, the requested information of just how the monitoring could be done, what it entailed, and what it would cost were not available. So the ordinance died for lack of a motion to take it off the table for a vote. However, two alternatives were available at this council meeting, and members discussed them even though the ordinance was no longer around. Essentially, the choice was to hire and train a part-time employee or to enter into an agreement with DEC to monitor the air quality. City Manager Doug Griffin said an employee expense could probably be reimbursable by Exxon. Council Member Sally McAdoo stated that she felt the community would fully support both. She said the city should ask for assistance and expertise from DEC, but should also hire its own agent.
For the peace of mind and of the community, and based on the number one priority for this community has been air quality, that we should hire monitors 24 hours a day to assure that the gas opacity is correct, that the burning is done at the right temperature, that the sorting is done according to how it's set up by the manufacturer. I believe that we need that monitoring to assure us that it's being done correctly. I believe that we should go a step further and check into the air quality monitor stations that need to be installed. And I believe that this is the type of instrument that we should charge against our service area 3. This community is talking in all corners about the quality of their air and their worries. I'm not sure if the other council are getting calls, but I am getting calls. And I'm getting calls from all walks of life that they want to make sure that we are not emitting anything into our air that is unsafe for us and for our children, for our visitors, including Exxon.
It took quite a bit of discussion, mainly over the wisdom of adding another city employee. But in the end, the council concurred that management should hire a consultant for air quality monitoring on a daily basis and should contact DEC to determine what amount of aid that agency could offer to Valdez. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The House Interior Subcommittee on Water and Power Resources is looking into the nation's readiness to respond to oil spills. Subcommittee aide Jeff Petrick says the panel, chaired by California Democrat George Miller, heard from a variety of industry experts and analysts with differing views on dealing with spills. But he says on one point there was no disagreement.
None of the witnesses, and we did have testimony from the industry, from the Environmental Protection Agency, from the Coast Guard, from the Minerals Management Service, and from an independent oil spill expert, not a single witness defended the response to the Exxon Valdez spill. It's absolutely clear that that response by Alyeska and then secondly by Exxon was totally deficient under any standard of response to such a spill.
The testimony was inconclusive on the more difficult question of whether the technology to deal with a major spill even exists yet. Alyeska's position has been that all the equipment in the world couldn't have contained the nearly 11 million gallons of crude that gushed from the Exxon Valdez on Good Friday. Petrick says the subcommittee isn't buying Alyeska's excuses, and that the testimony so far has shown that with, in his words, more equipment and a better attitude, Alyeska could have made much more of a dent in the Prince William Sound spill. The number one focus, he says, is to get the oil industry to make the necessary investment in the gear and training to bring its spill responsibilities up to date.
It's simply something that in the last few years, particularly as prices went down, that the industry was not interested whatsoever in giving priority to. And so that's obviously step number one, and it was very clear at the hearing that that's what needs to be done.
Oil industry spokespersons have proposed funding a $250 million strike force of response teams to deal with future spills in the lower 48. Tuesday's hearing was one of seven oil spill-related hearings taking place in Washington this month. Later this week, Senate panels review federal spill liability issues and oil spill contingency plans. Alaska witnesses include Attorney General Douglas Bailey and Environmental Conservation Commissioner Dennis Kelso. Congress appears ready to move on a package of oil spill legislation, dealing not only with liability and other legal issues, but also with safety and prevention. Petrick speculates that spill legislation could clear both houses of Congress by the end of the year. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Federal agencies evaluating the damage done by the Exxon Valdez oil spill are dragging their feet and trying to shut Alaska out of the process while giving a greater role to Exxon. Those charges were leveled at the Bush administration yesterday by State Fish and Game Commissioner Don Collinsworth. Collinsworth is Alaska's representative on a joint panel of what are known as trustee agencies, working to assess the damage done to fish and wildlife. In a letter to the Secretaries of Interior, Commerce, and Agriculture, Collinsworth said the Interior Department is trying to assume a leadership role in the assessment, a move Alaska objects to, because of that department's history of undervaluing damaged resources. A letter calls for a meeting in Washington next week to discuss the problems. More complaints were heard yesterday from outside Prince William Sound about Exxon's slowness to move its oil spill cleanup effort there. Kenai Fjords National Park Superintendent Ann Castellina says there's only one crew at work in the whole Seward cleanup area, in spite of the fact that Exxon has agreed with the area's management team about where and how to do the cleanup.
We sit at this table and we discuss these things, and everyone agrees, Coast Guard, Exxon, and all the members of the MAC group, that these are the things that need to be done. These are the resources that are needed. After many delays, we get these resources here. That's another frustration in itself. These resources get here, and yet we still do not see the progress being made. I don't know where it's falling apart. I really don't.
Castellina says Exxon and Vico have been decreasing, not increasing, the number of workers along the coast from Resurrection Bay to Gore Point. The Exxon Corporation submitted its version of the story of the oil spill yesterday. In comments to the National Transportation Safety Board on testimony gathered in May, the Exxon Shipping Company says there's not enough evidence on the record to show if Captain Joe Hazelwood was drunk when the tanker struck Bly Reef. Exxon also says none of its personnel practices contributed to the wreck, and its response to the spill was immediate and appropriate. Exxon's version of the event blames the third mate for not steering back into the shipping lane in time to avoid running hard aground on the reef.
Based on testimony from National Transportation Safety Board hearings in May, officials at both Alyeska and Exxon now say the panel should conclude they responded appropriately to the massive spill. In documents released yesterday, Alyeska repeated its complaint that its initial response was hampered because state regulators would not okay burning spilled oil or applying dispersant to it. And Alyeska now says its contingency plan was simply a guide to show what kind of resources would be used in very specific circumstances. Exxon says investigators should find the company's response to the spill was fast and correct. And despite tests showing the ship's captain was drunk hours after the grounding, Exxon now says whatever role alcohol may have played in the accident must remain a mystery. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
We're getting a little bit nervous at this point about how much more is going to get done. Or how much is going to be left undone that we could be doing now?
The incinerator issue is a very emotional one in Valdez. People here feel they've already had to accept enough, and they don't want additional risk. During public testimony last night, John Christensen, representing the IRA Council of the Village of Chenega Bay, spoke the feelings of many when he asserted that the minimum standards required by the law don't approach the pre-spill air quality of Prince William Sound, and further pollution at any level is unacceptable.
Zero tolerance regarding fish products and oil contamination is a reality. I think that zero tolerance should be extended to every aspect of this cleanup and any possible further damage to the environment.
Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Over 600 Upper Inlet Drift Gillnet salmon fishermen have spent a frustrating 3.5 weeks waiting and wondering if their nets would ever get into the water this season. Now they know. Paul Rouge says oil contamination has forced the Department of Fish and Game to shut down the Drift Gillnet fishery until August 5th.
Our continued test fishing out there really hasn't changed much in terms of the observations. It's a pretty static situation as regards the oil out there in the rips. Day after day, we find fairly similar concentrations, just an occasional tarball out there, but we continue to pick up one in the nets when we attempt test fishing every so often. So it's our opinion that we clearly could not have a fishery out there, and that situation also isn't likely to change in the near future. So in order to give everybody a little long-term outlook here so they can get on with their lives and do other things, we announced essentially a two-week closure.
Rouge says they'll look at reopening the area to fishing after August 5th because of other smaller localized runs that will be entering the inlet after the sockeyes. He says they don't want to rule out the possibility of the drifters harvesting those fish. But the sockeye run, which is worth literally millions of dollars to the drift gillnetters, is basically a total loss this year.
It's a little difficult to tell exactly where we're at in the sockeye run right now. I think we're past the peak and starting into the downside. Certainly, you know, as regards this closure, this will pretty much encompass all the sockeye return. There will be no significant drift catch of sockeye this year.
The Upper Inlet drifters have received a cash advance of $10,000 each from Exxon, and the oil company has made a commitment to compensate them for their losses. But it's more than money that has been lost. Jim Wells is an Upper Inlet drifter. He says the oil contamination has had a profound effect on his way of life this summer.
It's a sad day for us. It's the first year in 20 years that I haven't fished here. We're here. We got the boats ready to go. The nets are ready to go. The crewmen are here. Everything's, you know, you're right on the edge. So it's really hard. We're fishermen. That's our job. It'd be like an accountant without an office or, you know, a logger without any trees to work on. It's the same thing. You just, that's what you miss. It's a very sad thing.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Laura Wilkie.
Fishermen expected the oil to be heaviest in small coves along the ragged edge of the Kenai Fjords National Park, and Ann Castellina, superintendent of the park, says they were right.
Coves in the areas that collect naturally the most amount of debris, like your logs and your styrofoam and your nets and your floats, the kinds of things that beachcombers love to rummage through when they are out boating, those have been the areas that have also been the hardest hit by the oil, because those, of course, are the areas where the oil naturally goes. That's where the currents carry the oil as well as all this other debris.
Castellina says the oil from the Exxon Valdez didn't just wash ashore once. It's still draining out of Prince William Sound, collecting around the Chiswell Islands.
Well, we have also a research report that came in this weekend about additional oiling south of Pony Cove in Ialik, where oil has never been reported before. Some heavy oiling in that area.
When tides are high or after any kind of storm in the Gulf of Alaska, aging oil is lifted from already stained beaches and floats on down the coast, collecting debris, piling on top of already oiled garbage, or settling into new coves waiting to be picked up. The problem is, it's being picked up by the current again, not by cleanup crews. About a month and a half ago, Castellina says there were three cleanup crews working simultaneously in the Seward area. Boats were skimming oil, and there was quite a bit of activity, both on the beaches and in the water. Even though the area is far from clean and still being hit with more oil, the activity has dwindled.
Now what we have is cleanup going on in one area, and that's in Morning Cove in the Pie Islands, which are part of Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. There is no shoreline cleanup going on today on any of the other shorelines that have been identified by the multi-agency coordination group as requiring cleanup of any kind.
The heavy equipment needed for warm saltwater washing is on order, but hasn't arrived, and the list of beaches needing to be cleaned is still growing. But as Castellina says, Exxon hasn't hired any new crews, even just to walk the shore and pick up oil-coated debris and tar balls. The lack of response is extremely frustrating for Castellina and other members of the Seward MAC group. They've been told there are certainly people waiting to be hired. There's housing available.
We know that there's lists of things that need to be done, that there are work orders that we've written ourselves in detail explaining how the work could be accomplished if these these recommendations were accepted. These lists that we've given have been accepted by the Coast Guard and Exxon, and we've been told they would be acted upon. We're looking for the action right now.
Even if the action begins soon, the next problem will be where to put the oily debris. The Department of Environmental Conservation is holding hearings this week on the possibility of burning it in floating incinerators. Tonight's hearing is in Seward. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
The three small incinerators on Dayville Road were installed and put to use quite some time ago. The three are small enough not to need DEC permits, but they're large enough to burn 8 to 10 tons of oily waste each day. According to EPA, there is no data available anywhere on what this type of waste produces when burned. The DEC tested for regulated emissions at the beginning of the Dayville Road operation, but no tests have been run to date on dioxins or furans because there are no federal or state standards for those. And the only continuous monitoring of the Dayville Road incinerators to date is performed by Exxon personnel. That bothers the citizens of Valdez, and the concern for the invisible pollutants and continuous monitoring of all burning operations emerged over and over again during the question-answer period last night. Here's an example.
Who would monitor the emissions of all these systems that were described? Two of them made it clear in public, the other two had it too, that they would have a computer coming out, it would show it continuously. On whose desk is that modem, that who's watching that continuous monitoring?
We don't plan on imposing requirements for monitoring of that type with a modem hookup.
Why not?
Expense, largely. We will require continuous emission monitors with recording equipment, do frequent inspections of the facilities. We've contemplated having onboard observers during this test burn, in fact, to monitor the burning.
How often?
We haven't determined an inspection schedule yet. I would anticipate no less than twice a week, and we are, as I mentioned, contemplating onboard observers, if that can be arranged.
And will those onboard observers have the authority to stop operations if it goes off where it's supposed to be?
Yes.
Why do they have three instead of one?
You'd have to ask Exxon Shoreway, I guess.
I'm sorry, I just asked a question.
Why do you have three incinerators instead of one? You might be aware that we all think this because that size is not regulated.
Yeah, I've certainly heard that expressed a number of times that we're attempting to operate under a loophole. That was not the intent. The reason we had three incinerators is that these units were chosen because they were quickly available. Their emissions were well below the levels of the
largest. Even as three combined?
Yes, if you combined all three of them, they would still be way below the levels for the largest units of the state standards.
Questions about the resultant ash at the Dayville Road incinerators yielded the information that about two-thirds of the first batch tested were high in cadmium and therefore classified as a hazardous waste and disposed of accordingly. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The Interior Secretary says moratoria, such as the one now being considered by Congress, won't be specifically attacked by the Bush administration. He says the year-long ban adopted by the House and pending now in the Senate is a kind of cheap approach taken up by lawmakers who oppose offshore drilling but don't have enough votes to ban it permanently. Speaking at the annual meeting of Western Governors, Lujan said the administration would go to work on the Senate trying to convince lawmakers there to drop the moratorium. And Lujan said the proposed ban comes just as experts continue to predict vast reserves are waiting off the U.S. coast.
Reputable geologists tell us that more than 5 billion barrels of known oil reserves lie in the Gulf of Mexico and off the coast of California. Studies by the U.S. Geological Survey and the Minerals Management Service indicate that about 19 and perhaps as many as 32 billion barrels of undiscovered oil remain off our shores waiting to be tapped. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge offers the possibility of another 3 and possibly 9 billion barrels of oil. But the fact is, exploring these areas, developing these wells, getting production underway, is a long, costly, and time-consuming process.
Lujan says the proposed ban would even prevent studies into what kind of problems would be faced if offshore drilling went ahead in any of these areas. Alaska Governor Steve Cooper supports the proposed drilling ban, which would cover the lucrative fishing grounds in Bristol Bay. Lujan said worry about oil spills following the wreck of the Exxon Valdez is misdirected when it's turned against offshore oil development. The Interior Secretary says as long as offshore rigs maintain their relatively clean record, at least since the 1969 disaster at Santa Barbara, it's wrong to penalize developers. Lujan says it makes more sense to scrutinize the shipping industry, and he called for studies aimed at decreasing the amount of oil carried by ships. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
12 to 15 people yelled protests against Exxon while Elise T. Scott of Anchorage, also known as Elise Bedsworth, blocked access to the building, having chained herself in place with bicycle locks. When asked to leave, Scott refused, saying she had lost the keys. Responding officers cut her loose with bolt cutters and arrested her for criminal trespass in second degree. In court, Scott pled not guilty and asked for a change of venue to Homer. She was released on $100 bail. Acting Assistant Police Chief Bert Cottle says this is the only public demonstration against Exxon in Valdez that he can remember since the early days of the spill, when a Greenpeace member was evicted from a news conference. Cottle said that Scott indicated that the group staging the protest yesterday was a newly formed coalition, but he couldn't remember the name given. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
In a lawsuit filed in Harris County, Texas, which includes Exxon's Houston offices, former Exxon worker Ken Davis charges that Exxon wrongfully fired and slandered him. Davis has admitted he inadvertently erased backup computer tapes that included documents relating to the Prince William Sound oil spill. Davis's lawyer, David Berg, says the destruction of spill tapes was much more widespread than has been reported so far.
We know of at least six other employees who erased tapes with oil spill material on it.
According to Berg, in the complaint filed against Exxon, at least two other tape-erasing incidents occurred, involving information going back to the first days after the spill. As an example, Berg cited a case that occurred in May, involving a woman he declined to identify who apparently had been inadvertently erasing tapes for over a month, and Berg says Exxon knew about it. He says oil spill information was also erased on April 24th, destroying copies of documents dating back to March 24th, the day of the spill. The attorney says Davis talked Wednesday with a computer expert hired by the state of Alaska, who confirmed Davis's claim that the only complete record of Exxon spill communications for certain days may now be lost. Exxon attorney Richard Clinton says he doesn't know what Berg's talking about when he refers to other tapes being erased, but he pointed out that backup tapes were routinely erased at Exxon. In affidavits filed Wednesday in Anchorage, Exxon officials repeated the company's claim that no primary spill information has been destroyed and provided some documents on how the backup tapes were erased. Exxon employee Lydia Mayforth's affidavit states that Davis supervised the writing over of computer tapes with spill information despite repeated warnings not to do so. Mayforth described Davis as rude and sarcastic and says he was fired not simply because of the tape incident, but because of a pattern of refusing to follow reasonable instructions. Attorneys for Exxon also say that the court's order to preserve documents does not include redundant copies such as these tapes. In his complaint, Davis claims Exxon slandered him by spreading false statements about his work performance as part of the company's justification for firing him. His attorney stopped short of charging that Exxon planned the destruction of the tapes and then set Davis up to take the blame for it, but points out that if some critical document has been destroyed or lost, Alaska and other plaintiffs may have no way of knowing that because the backup copies are gone.
It is the classic case of the Exxon fox guarding the oil spill chicken coop.
Exxon attorney Clinton says in a corporation the size of Exxon, there are usually several copies of most documents. Clinton said in an interview from his Seattle office Thursday that it's inconceivable to him that at least one copy of all the spill documents doesn't exist somewhere. Berg says he's willing to bring Ken Davis to Anchorage at his own expense to testify in court if Exxon's attorneys will agree to let him cross-examine their witnesses and subpoena Exxon documents to back up his case. Clinton said he doesn't know if Exxon would have any objections to that arrangement, adding that the decision would be up to the court. Clinton also said that Exxon has asked for permission to release Davis's personnel file to the public, but Berg has refused. Davis's complaint asked for unspecified damages and attorney's fees. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Acting Assistant Police Chief Bert Cottle says yesterday's ruckus is the only public demonstration involving Exxon that he can remember since the early days of the spill, when a Greenpeace member with a dead otter was removed from a news conference at the Civic Center. Cottle says it was early yesterday morning, just before 8:30, when the Valdez Police Department received a call from security at the Exxon building, reporting that there was an individual chained to the door denying access into the building. Responding officers found a 28-year-old female of Anchorage by the name of Elise T. Scott, also known as Elise Bedsworth.
She had taken two bicycle padlocks made of a quarter-inch steel type and chained herself to the front doors. She was asked to leave by security. She refused. She was asked to leave by the officers who responded. She refused, stating that she had did not have the keys or had lost the keys to the bicycle lock, one of which was around her neck. Responding officers obtained a pair of bolt cutters, cut the lock off, and she was arrested for criminal trespass in the second degree. She was taken to court. She pled not guilty, was released on $100 bail, and she asked for a change of venue that the case be heard in Homer.
According to Cottle, the woman chained to the door of the Exxon Command Center was accompanied by approximately 12 to 15 others.
They were yelling protests against Exxon and Exxon's cleanup and stating, "Exxon, go home."
None of those were arrested. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Early on, committee members questioned a shift in rhetoric used to describe the cleanup. They noted the word treatment instead of cleanup is now being used to describe recovery efforts. Coast Guard Admiral Paul Yost was asked if that's a retreat from earlier promises about cleanup.
If we reassessed, it's to attempt to stabilize the beach to the point that wildlife and fish are not going to be damaged in the future by the oil that's left on that beach. That's what treatment means to me, that oil is not going to continually wash off the beach, oil other beaches. It's not going to be so heavy that it's hurting wildlife using the beach, and it's not going to put toxicity into the water column.
Yost said cleanup crews will be sorely pressed to reach that level for the hundreds of miles of affected beach by the September 15th target date. But he said Exxon's efforts have sped up near to where the Coast Guard thinks they should be. Senator Ted Stevens, a committee member, asked why September 15th has to be the target date. He argued as much as possible should be done this year, weather permitting.
It does seem to me the cost of mobilization next year is going to be horrendous as compared to the cost of keeping this effort going this year, and that every gallon of oil that's recovered this year is a gallon that's not going to move to another beach by next year, because it's not going to disappear.
Stevens also argued little is being done to clean affected areas beyond Prince William Sound. He asked Admiral Yost to make an assessment.
Are you satisfied now with the efforts outside of the Prince William Sound of the Exxon company and its employees to try and deal with that problem outside the sound?
There's more dissatisfaction outside the sound than any place else in this oil cleanup process.
Alaska's environmental conservation chief, Dennis Kelso, added other concerns to the list. One, solid waste disposal. Kelso said piles of discarded cleanup materials are mounting and Exxon has no place to put them. He argued Exxon's plan to incinerate the waste could create cancer-causing toxins. Another strike against Exxon, Kelso said, is its reluctance to experiment with new cleanup tools and methods.
This really is a good time to look at a variety of technical approaches. And we think that although it's perfectly legitimate for Exxon to look at the things they have been looking at, we think they've looked at too narrow an array.
Kelso's comments about incineration and technology issues showed the strain in the arranged marriage between the state and Exxon. Exxon President William Stevens argued his company has tried to work with Kelso and other state officials, but have only met roadblocks.
I question very, very seriously whether Mr. Kelso is sincerely interested in us getting this job done.
But all sides took pains to say that despite the bickering, they're committed to cleaning up the mess. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
Are you satisfied now with the efforts outside of the Prince William Sound?
There's more dissatisfaction outside the sound than any place else in this oil cleanup process.
I am not going to allow Ken Davis to be deposed under these circumstances with no judge anywhere to be found, because I know these people. They're brutal. They'll sit him down for 3 and 4 weeks and try to wear him out and beat him down. And if they are going to dump on this man, then I want to see them in court.
And that every gallon of oil that's recovered this year is a gallon that's not going to move to another beach by next year, because it's not going to disappear.
Upper Cook Inlet drift fisherman Frank Mullen said the action taken wasn't planned in advance, but something that just happened on the spur of the moment. Mullen said the idea started with a phone call Thursday afternoon, and by 6 o'clock in the evening, 15 vessels were sitting in the inlet just outside the Nikiski dock, waiting for the 900-foot tanker, the Flying Clipper, to arrive. Mullen said the Coast Guard was on scene and was able to convince a few boats to move away from the tanker, but a number of others decided not to back off and came as close as 50 feet to the bow of the tanker. Mullen said he was able to monitor the radio transmissions between the tanker and oil company officials waiting on the dock.
The people on the dock were communicating with the skipper of the Flying Clipper at this point, and they said, just come on in, come on ahead, don't worry about those small vessels. They are just playing chicken with you, and they will move. And the Flying Clipper did indeed continue on its course and very slowly, and came up and was able to tie up to the dock.
Mullen said there were no accidents or injuries as a result of the action taken. He said the blockade was really more of an escort, and that the fishermen were not interested in putting anyone's life in danger. What they were really trying to do was make a point. Mullen said the fishermen feel Exxon's cleanup effort has been slow and ineffective, and the company's lack of action is the reason the upper inlet drift season has been shut down. He also said Cook Inlet fishermen are upset over the continuing failure of anyone to receive compensation from the Glacier Bay oil spill 2 years ago. Mullen said he's usually pretty level-headed, but the events of the last 4 months have made him take a different approach.
Gosh, if you'd have told me a year ago or 2 years ago that I'd have been involved in an effort to blockade a tanker, I'd have probably argued you with it. But you look at the extreme actions that have come through the state of Alaska as a result of this oil spill, you know, we see that Exxon's effort to clean up oil and pick up oil, not only in Cook Inlet, but you know, in other areas of Alaska, have been in many instances ineffective, and in many other instances non-existent. There's just not enough being done, and what is being done in many cases is done being done for show as much as anything, and that's a tragedy in itself.
Mullen said the blockade was a one-time-only protest, and there are no plans for any other types of demonstrations. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
Most of the testimony and questioning concentrated on compensation and two international protocols which provide compensation for cleanup and damages resulting from foreign oil tanker spills. Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner told the subcommittee the administration would like these protocols to be ratified by Congress.
The question we must ask as we go through this process is, why should Americans suffer all the costs of oil pollution caused by foreign tankers when an international system exists to pay for cleanup and damages? In 1988, foreign flag vessels accounted for some 59% of the oil spilled by tankers and tank barges. A vote for the protocols is a vote for the environment.
But Alaska and other states are dead set against ratification of the protocols because they would preempt state liability laws concerning oil spills. Alaska's Attorney General Douglas Bailey says if the protocols had been in effect when the Exxon Valdez went aground, Alaska would have had even more problems.
I believe that only what is presently our patchwork system of state laws, including those in place in Alaska, whereby the owners of the oil have responsibility to the full financial extent of their resources, has been what has prodded Exxon Corporation to fulfill the steps that it has taken in Alaska. And I greatly fear that had the protocols been in place and applicable, that Exxon's presence would have disappeared a long time ago, and that it would have provided to them an escape hatch from a sinking ship.
Compensation for oil spill victims was also a topic discussed by the subcommittee. Bailey testified that there should be no limits on direct and indirect compensation.
Alaska is concerned about its environment. Alaska is also an oil state. We are very much an oil state, and we are in the oil business. And if we are to continue with other states to gather the public respect and confidence in the system of producing and transporting oil that we must have, then we have to have a full compensation system in place. It's short-sighted, in my view, on the part of other states and businesses, entities that are in the oil business, to try and obtain temporary safeguards that will foreclose their futures.
Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Dennis Kelso had other concerns. He said Alaska had a good oil spill contingency plan, but there wasn't enough oversight.
Although there was an approved plan, it was not carried out. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company failed to do what the plan required, and Exxon abandoned the plan entirely and just used something else that had not been approved. So essentially, we have to have both of the elements of that if it's going to work, and the government, whether it's the Coast Guard or the state, or preferably in this kind of spill, the two working in conjunction, need to be able to direct how those plans are carried out.
Subcommittee members say the oil spill legislation is on the fast track, and members hope to have a bill on the Senate floor by September. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Chris Kirby in Washington, D.C.
An Exxon memo dated Friday makes 3 points. It says, 1, Exxon will select demobilization dates based on safety and operational considerations, and all equipment will be fully demobilized. 2, for safety and operational reasons, Exxon will conduct no cleanup operations during the winter. 3, our only commitment for the spring of 1990 is to survey the shorelines, and these are not negotiable points. The memo continues, saying no commitment should be made to any private or government party on any of these 3 points. It says our discussions with federal or state agencies is for the purpose of keeping them informed and is not requesting approval. In discussions on these matters, you should stress the safety and operational factors. We are willing to discuss these factors. We are not willing to discuss the decisions. Exxon officials say only that the memo follows guidelines outlined to Congress by Exxon President Bill Stevens. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley. Public testimony was brief, centering around needs and concerns that people feel have not been taken care of with Senate Bill 154. One request came from Cordovan Rose Arvidson, who spoke to the need for a social, psychological, and cultural study of the communities affected by the spill. She testified that friendships and families have gone through upheavals, and although there is funding for the cleanup, there is no funding for the people. Senator Curtula, who chairs the Legislative Audit and Budget Committee, says these types of social issues were probably authorized but haven't been pushed by the appropriate persons, and he says that's where his committee can help.
I would say that these concerns voiced, we can give quite a bit of pressure on their behalf. Yeah.
Reporting for Cordova, I'm Sue Rapley.